Hello and welcome to Sip for Speech, the podcast for professionals in public finance. This week's episode is a health sector bonanza. We'll be kicking off with Alistair McLellan, editor of the Health Service Journal, to get his take on the COVID-19 headlines over the past few months. And then later on in the episode, SIPFA's Kate Latimer spoke to Anita Charlesworth from the Health Foundation to explore a more underreported impact of COVID-19, the number of deaths that are not COVID-related. First and foremost, though, over to Alistair.
I'm here with Alistair McLellan, editor of the Health Service Journal. Thank you for joining us today, Alistair.
It's okay.
How have you been finding the lockdown and pandemic experience so far?
Well, I was very pleased when the homeschooling finished. But other than that, I think I've had a pretty easy lockdown.
Excellent. Glad to hear it. So for our listeners' benefit, could you tell them a bit about your background and how you found your way to the Health Service Journal?
So I've been a journalist for 34 years, and I spent the first half of my career mostly writing about the construction engineering sectors, though I did spend 6 months as the news editor of public finance in the early 90s, and then I joined HSJ as editor in April 2002.
So suffice to say, COVID-19 has been a bit of a roller coaster for all involved. What do you feel have been the main challenges in the health service, and how have those challenges evolved over time?
Well, I think most people listening to this podcast will realise that the first challenge was to address the fear that the rise in infections would overwhelm the NHS to an extent where it couldn't effectively function. And that was the driving motivation of almost everything else that happened in that first stage. So you got a situation where all the focus was on making sure that the intensive care capacity in the NHS was maximised in any possible way. And that was the only objective, the only game in town. So basically everything else stopped. And the NHS was very successful at that. Maybe it was a little too successful in that actually the demand that actually emerged wasn't what they feared. And maybe they could have maintained more routine services than they actually did. But it's perfectly understandable to see how they erred on the side of caution. We did not see the kind of scenes that we saw in northern Italy at the start of the pandemic, of course. Since then, of course, the priority has shifted over the summer to how the NHS can begin to restore the services, particularly elective and for cancer, and to get ready for a returning demand of emergency care. And there's been a lot of planning and a lot of development around that over the summer. Now, as we enter the second wave, and that's very clear that we are entering a second wave, it is a combination of the both. How do you maintain that spare intensive care capacity in case things get out of hand, while still continuing to provide routine services? Not quite at the level pre-pandemic, very close to it.
Okay, so as editor of the HSJ, yourself and your colleagues have a lot of touch points with leaders in the health service. Based on your interactions with those professionals across that spectrum, what would you say that the overall sentiment is as far as the government's leadership around COVID is concerned? So public criticism has largely been around the lack of clarity around the rules. Obviously, we've had new rules that were put in place in the Prime Minister's statement yesterday. Do practitioners feel like the government has done or is doing enough to support them through this crisis?
Well, that is indeed a very loaded question. And I think you would find a wide range of opinion amongst the leaders of the health service who make up HSJ's readership, including, of course, many finance directors who are SIPFA members. I think it's very hard to generalise here, but I think there is a view about how the government is handling perhaps the more societal elements of the pandemic, the kind of messages that they've been sending to people about their behaviours. Then you've got the particular initiatives like NHS Test and Trace to sort of help deal with the pandemic, but also help the NHS, because Test and Trace is very important to the restoration of NHS services. And then you've got the support for the NHS. So in reverse order, if you like, I think the NHS leadership, both at national and local level, are pretty happy with the levels of support the NHS has been given. Protect the NHS has been the government's motto. And they certainly have spent a lot of money and are continuing to spend a lot of money in supporting on the NHS through COVID. When it comes to the kind of behavioural messages that the government have been sending to the public about their behaviours, I think our readership reflects the views in the nation, in that there's a lot of frustration and confusion out there, mm-hmm. while at the same time, perhaps this is something that is discreet to this sort of recognising quite how difficult a challenge it is. When it comes to individual projects like Test and Trace, or particularly Test and Trace, I think there is very, very deep concern that is going badly wrong, and that is really hindering the ability of the NHS to restore services in a way that the government wants.
So one of the key issues that the pandemic has highlighted more so than ever is the interdependence of health and social care, and this is something that SIPFA has taken quite a lot of interest in. Do you think that the pandemic is likely to represent a turning point on what is quite a thorny policy agenda?
Not particularly. The problems with social care reform are that it's very, very expensive, and that expense would tend to fall, is likely to fall, on those people who are likely to vote, for a start, so, you know, you don't want to piss them off. And given that there will be a redistributive element to any reform, rich people paying more than people aren't as well off, then obviously for this government, that's a particular problem. I was speaking to somebody very much in the know around social care reform, and I said, you know, have they got a plan? Has the government got a plan? And they said, no, still, there is still no plan. The sentiment is there and repeatedly expressed, but there is no plan as we speak now. We are no further forward than we have been for a number of years. As far as I can tell, the government's just hoping that a miracle suddenly occurs. Now, the integration of health and social care, as opposed to about social care reform, yes, I think there is some interesting peripheral action on that. But until you sort the money out, it's all pretty much, you know, dancing around the main subject. You cannot fully integrate health and social care in the way that many people amongst HSJ readership and the SIPFA membership might want, until you can sort out how you fund the services, and both how you fund them and how you deal with the shortfall in social care funding.
Indeed, it often does come back to the money, doesn't it? So the Health Service Journal recently published a story focusing in on a confidential document from the Medway Foundation Trust, indicating that a second COVID peak 5 times harder than it did back in April. You touched earlier on the issue around the NHS being able to deal with routine issues or issues that are non-COVID related. Later in the episode, we'll actually be talking to Anita Charlesworth from the Health Foundation about exactly that, about the acceleration of non-COVID related deaths that we're also seeing at the moment alongside the COVID second wave. All of this in mind, how do you think that this will all manifest in patient care, both in relation to COVID itself and the NHS's ability to treat other conditions as we continue into the second wave and into the winter? The crucial question is whether it'll be able to cope.
Indeed it is the crucial question. So if you actually look at the levels, the NHS has come back on stream pretty quickly, actually, in most areas. Of course, it's come back on stream in different ways. Most hospital outpatients activity is now taking place remotely, for example, as is a lot of GP contact and quite a lot of mental health as well. So we really don't know. It depends on how badly COVID hits us during the autumn and the winter. And of course, it won't be the same everywhere. In the southwest, for example, I think I'll stick my neck out and suggest that, you know, all things being equal, they should have pretty much a normal winter. There's not a lot of COVID around in the southwest, and there shouldn't be a lot of COVID around in the southwest to the degree that it actually really seriously affects their ability to carry out cancer care, for example. The northeast, the northwest, very different picture. Midlands, it's looking a bit wobbly. London, very low levels now, but starting to pick up. Southeast, east of England, looking okay. And of course, even within those seven regions, there are a lot of variations between a city like Norwich and a town like Bury St Edmunds, for example. So there is no doubt that what we've got is a scenario in which the variation in healthcare, which is always there, as with all public services, is very likely to be accentuated as the second wave begins to bite.
So you touched briefly there at the beginning on the way that the NHS has adapted and the move towards more virtual patient care, virtual GP appointments. I hate the phrase the new normal. I keep seeing it everywhere. But do you think that if we do return to any sort of state of normal, things that we've adapted for COVID, are they likely to stick around?
Well, I mean, I think it's important not to get carried away. The great majority, and I stress the great majority of these remote consultations have taken place on a phone. Indeed, people were saying that the NHS had leapt forward 10 years in the space of 6 months during COVID. Yes, it's leapt forward from 1990 to 2000. We haven't entered some brave new world of docs on your smartphones in video form. That said, I asked that question myself, a lot of people who I talk to in the NHS. I think it's, if I would pick out one area, I'd say follow-up hospital outpatient appointments. I think it's going to be very, very rare indeed for people to be asked to come back in person to a hospital for a follow-up hospital outpatient appointment. There may be cases where they have to for some kind of physical exam or something, but as a default, some very senior medics I've talked to have said this to me, as a default, I just don't think follow-up appointments, physical follow-up appointments, they'll be the exception that proves the rule. I think we will see a lot more phone triaging, both in primary care. You ring up your doctor's appointment, GP rings you back, has a quick chat to you about it, says whether you need to come in or not. And of course, we're about to get the rollout of the call before you walk A&E system, which they hate that in NHS England, but the NHS 111 first, as its official name is, where you ring up 111 and you are triaged to a range of services. And it may be they say, oh, you do actually need to come in for A&E and we'll book a slot for you. Doesn't mean it doesn't stop walk-ins and it doesn't stop blue lights, but it is, it's the default way to engage with the NHS. So yes, hospital outpatients, particularly follow-ups, they're going to go remote, telephone or an increasing video, and there'll be a lot more use of digital triaging, phone or other things, in primary and emergency care.
Brilliant. So I think that's about all we've got time for. So thank you very much today, Alistair, for joining us.
That's all right. Thank you.
Thanks again to Alistair for joining us this week. Next up, we're joined by Anita Charlesworth from the Health Foundation. Anita had been battling off a pretty nasty cold ahead of our interview, but she pushed through to be with us in this week's episode to discuss some of the wider impacts the pandemic has had on the ability of the health service to handle non-COVID related issues.
Hi, I'm Kate Latimer and I'm here with Anita Charlesworth, Director of Research at the Real Centre for the Health Foundation. Do you mind just starting by telling us a little bit about yourself and the work it is you do for the Health Foundation?
I'm a health economist by background, worked in government for a lot of years and then the for trust, and for the last 6 years been at the Health Foundation. At the Health Foundation, we're an independent, not-for-profit charitable foundation, work on improving healthcare, social care and the health of the nation.
So obviously the COVID-19 pandemic has had a huge effect on, everybody across the world, not just for COVID-19 patients, people who've suffered from COVID-19, but also non-COVID related healthcare issues. So in general terms, what have been the main impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic on non-COVID related healthcare services? And how has this affected those with specific healthcare needs?
So I think what we see is a threefold impact. On the demand side, we can see this almost in terms of phases or waves of impact. So obviously, when COVID-19 first started to have significant impact on the health service from March onwards and through lockdown, and that period where we had large numbers of admissions and a very high rate of excess deaths in the country, what we saw was we had to stop a lot of healthcare for non-COVID in order to create capacity, but also to protect people from the risk of COVID. And so a lot of care was halted. The other thing that happened was, in order to make services safe, care had to be provided in different ways. That was the first wave, but actually then COVID affects demand beyond that first wave. We've got people who've had COVID and thankfully survived, who've got long-term issues as a result of that. So there's an emerging discussion in the press about what people are calling long COVID, which is people not recovering fully and seeing consequences of it for prolonged periods and who need help through that period. There are also a lot of the people who got COVID-19 were very elderly and already had complex health needs. And we know if you're older, got lots of comorbidities and frail, and you have a setback in your health, it's very hard to get back to the level of functioning that you had before that health event occurred. And obviously, for many people, older people who survived COVID, it was a major health event for them. And they will struggle to get back to where they were. And so their health needs and their care needs are probably changed for the long term. And their level of independence and functionality will be affected. We've also seen that the economic and social measures that we've had to take to manage COVID have consequences. So shielding, lockdown, the issues around people losing jobs and the economic impact, young people's lives disrupted. All those things, surveys are showing, are beginning to manifest in a higher burden of mental ill health, which is starting to flow through into the service. But I would say that I think one of the things the health service is increasingly aware of, and particularly when you speak to people like GPs who are frontline, is that this is beginning to start to impact. And with children going back to school, I think schools, which often pick up a lot of need, will also be picking that up. And then the other thing we've seen, obviously, is that where we had to halt care, we've built up backlogs of waiting. So we've now got half of the people waiting for hospital treatment have waited for more than 18 weeks, which is the NHS's target. We've also, and this is one of the things that is particularly worrying for people, seen a backlog with cancer, where the number of people being referred for suspected cancers is much lower. In the peak of lockdown in kind of April, it was 60% lower than April of the year before. At the moment, it's about 20% lower. And the worry here is that patients with cancer are going to be detected at a later stage of cancer than they normally would do. And late stage diagnosis is associated with poorer outcomes, poorer prognosis. On the cost side, we've got the direct cost of COVID, of PPE, of running the huge network of test and trace, issues around staff costs as well. And then on the capacity side, to make services COVID safe, we can't have the same throughput in many cases as we have before. If you think about things like some of the diagnostic services like endoscopy, that's obviously by its very nature a high risk intervention in a COVID setting. So cleanings, handover between patients, all those issues are slower. Even down to simple things like, one of the things we need to do at the moment is vaccinate people for winter flu if we're to get through. Now, the rate at which people typically are vaccinated is incredibly high. It's a really efficient process, one in, one out, very fast turnaround. Now they're going to have gaps between people so that they don't cross over, opportunities to clean more as well in the space. So the staff you'll need to deliver a vaccine programme will be more than previously would be the case. Those are the main impacts that we're seeing at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, there's been reports published by the ONS to say that the rise in non-COVID related deaths that were recorded up until May this year have now returned back to a more normal level. But as you're saying, there must be some sort of very long-term effects, which we will see on the rate of death sort of way into the future.
Yes, it's important to say that, I mean, obviously, death is incredibly important. The NHS does all it can to prolong people's life, but also the NHS is there as well to protect our health. And some of these health impacts, particularly when you think about mental ill health, are not necessarily visible in the mortality data, but they're real. So the NHS is here not just to delay death, it is also here to keep us well while we're alive. the backlog of patients with wait on the waiting list. Some of those things may have effects on life expectancy. Some of them will not, but that doesn't mean they're not important.
Yeah, it just contributes to quality of life.
Yes.
So what would you say is the current state of our healthcare service? Would you say that the backlog has started to be worked down a little bit, or are we still in quite a bad position, would you say?
I think the position at the moment is that there's an immense amount of work going into preparing for winter. In a way, at the moment, there are things which give the NHS, I think, more optimism about its position at the moment than, say, in March. I think we have learned an immense amount about COVID-19 in this period. Treatment actually is moving forward. How to manage patients, what the right clinical pathway is, has moved forward quite a lot. So our understanding of the disease is vastly better, clearly, than it was before. The NHS has had this incredibly intense period of learning how to organise itself to manage COVID patients and manage them well. So we've got all that learning, all that experience, all that improvement and development. We've also shown that we can do an amazing amount to transform services. So you know, the movement of services to digital first, the changes that have been made, and we talked about this month actually, of ringing 111 before you go to A&E. And actually the NHS has also seen that the public is incredibly responsive and flexible and adaptive to that. So that all gives us heart that, you know, we can do quite well. The things that I think worry people a great deal about our ability to be resilient over the coming 6 months is we're now facing the potential of COVID-19 coinciding with winter pressures.
Yeah.
And winter pressures are hard for the NHS in normal times. And this is why the flu vaccination programme is so important. And getting things like A&E and emergency care pathways clear for people that work so that we minimise, if you like, the amount of pressure on the service and congestion in the system. So that's one set of anxieties, I think, about the coming period. The second set of anxieties are that staff have done amazing things, but they're exhausted.
Yeah.
So our ability to sustain the sort of staffing model for this is obviously very challenging, and we need all the bits of the system to work. And so I think the NHS is worried about testing, tracking and tracing working and working quickly.
Yeah, I mean, in your opinion, what would you say needs to happen? As you were saying, I mean, there's a big worry that there will be a potential second wave of COVID-19 during the winter months, where vulnerable people tend to require more healthcare and treatment anyway. What would you say needs to happen to ensure that this doesn't happen again?
So we need to minimise the winter risks and maximise our resilience to them. So minimising the winter risks clearly is particularly around the flu vaccination programme and really making sure that we get very good take up, that we get services ready for winter and working well. In terms of resilience then, I think a lot of the things that we know are really important then. So the way that the healthcare service is working with social care, so that service users in social care can be held at home, supported at home. So there's, you know, excellent work going on to fast track the advanced health in care homes, which will see GPs assigned to care homes to support their needs. Again, taking the pressure off needing to refer vulnerable, particularly elderly people, from care homes into acute hospitals. So those sorts of initiatives, making sure that the funding is in place for a really smooth transition where people do need to go into hospital, out back into community services again. Ensuring that we design in vaccination programmes so that we're maximising things like pharmacists there, so that GP time is being kept for other needs. These are all things that we need to make sure that we're doing. Getting in place some of the measures we need around staffing, which was in part to make sure that staff get tested when they need it, that all that is working very well. And that if people are symptomatic in things like social care, they are able to stay at home. they don't face a real financial hurdle to doing that. The thing with this, I think, is that there's no silver bullet.
So in your opinion, what do you think the future holds for the NHS? I mean, how long in the future do you think we'll feel the effects of COVID-19? Do you think it would be months, years, perhaps decades?
Let's take the optimistic scenario that a vaccine is developed, very effective and implemented next year. But I guess the impact on the NHS is really then very much dictated, I think, by what the backlog of care and need looks like. Particularly, there are some things, you know, that really are unlikely to go away very rapidly. So for the elderly people who've had COVID, they won't rebound, and so this is probably a step change for a lot of them in their healthcare needs. The mental health impact, depending on what the economic, you know, how quickly the economy rebounds, that will have a big role, obviously, in some of the mental health impact, but some of the mental health impact will be there even if the economy rebounds pretty quickly. The other thing that is really with us is that we've changed services very significantly in some very positive ways. I think people don't want to go back. Many services we will use differently going forward. Very positively, lots of people in the NHS talk about, you know, teams having come together, worked together remarkably effectively and broken down professional barriers, broken down the silos between different organisations. So, you know, in lots of parts of the country, people are saying the NHS has had this mantra of thinking system first rather than organisational first for a few years now. And I think most people admit that they struggled really to make a reality of that slogan. And in many parts of the country, they really have moved forward leaps and bounds in working together as a system. You would hope that that's one of the really positive legacies and we don't let that go. But actually, always with these sort of changes and these seismic moments, it's easy to underestimate the kind of forces of stasis and how easy it is to fall back into sort of bad old ways. And actually, if we want there to be a really positive legacy of COVID for the way we work, for the way we value our workforce, the way we think about things from a system, not individual organisation perspective, all those changes will need to be nurtured and looked after and embedded. It will be all too easy for bad ways to creep back in. Finally, I guess, we will almost certainly have to think much harder about how we make our system more resilient, because, you know, remarkable things have been done, but actually, you know, we've always run our system really hot. We've got low capacity, if you think about diagnostics, if you think about beds, if you think about staff in particular, and we've worked our system really hard. That's led the NHS to be incredibly efficient, but it's also meant that actually it's really hard to manage a crisis like this. And actually, we did have to shift from being an NHS service to be a COVID service for a short period of time.
Yeah.
For a short period of time, that was unavoidable, and it was probably just about manageable. But actually, the consequences, if that goes on for too long, would be high. And I don't think any of us ever want to be there again. I guess the other thing is this pandemic has shown actually how vitally important public health and health prevention is. And the network of people who most of the public don't see and don't interact with day to day, but they're an integral part of the health system in this country. And it's been an area we've underinvested in and actually cut since 2013. And that has come back to bite us. So you've got to hope that one of the lessons that we take out of this is we should never take for granted the public health infrastructure. And actually, that needs investment and nurturing on a constant basis. You can't suddenly just turn it on, you know, when you're in the eye of a storm.
Yeah.
Equally, we've seen that the failure to address the glaring challenges in social care over at least a 20-year period have impacted significantly on the ability of that sector to manage in the early phases of this crisis. So systemic policy failure compounded the problems that COVID would undoubtedly have brought to social care, but compounded those.
Yeah.
And you've got to hope that one of the lessons of the impacts of COVID-19 is that finally social care gets the attention and the funding that it deserves for a holistic solution to some of that sector's problems.
Absolutely. Okay, well, thanks very much for joining me today.
You're welcome.
You've been listening listening to Sip for Speaks, and that was Anita Charlesworth from the Health Foundation. We here at Sipfor are wishing you a speedy recovery from your cold, Anita. That's about all we've got time for this week, and as always, if you have any suggestions for topics you'd like us to investigate on the podcast, please do drop us a line at media@sipfor.org. Until then, we'll see you next time.